Coming up on Mind Your Business, I have in studio with me Eric Enquist, Assisting Managing Editor at Crain's New York Business. So many people read his work, but tonight you get to hear him on Mind Your Business on 77 WABC, all coming up.
It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
You're tuned to another edition of Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis right here on 77 WABC in the New York, New Jersey metro area and worldwide at WABCBizRadio.com. I apologize for the way I sound a little bit, but it's the winter thing, but thank God, all into it and looking forward to an amazing show. This show, as our audience knows, is about the getting you ahead in the business world. Each week, we interview a C-level executive or a business leader from many types of industries. And tonight's actually the first time we have the journalist, a journalist in studio, and we're going to touch on the field of journalism. So stay tuned for an incredible edition of Mind Your Business, where you will hear all types of business ideas and strategies and advice to get you ahead in today's business world. Special thank you to the show's producer, Pesach Tropper, Meira Bauman, the content creator who helps develop the questions, etc., and the entire team at Bottom Line Marketing Group, who plays an important role in the development of this show. Also, special thank you to last week's guest, Peter Shankman, best-selling author, entrepreneur, speaker, and worldwide connector. The podcast is available by going to WABCBizRadio.com, WABCBizRadio.com. Later on in the show, we also will give a shout-out and to the winners of the Dan Sullivan book bundle. A couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Dan Sullivan, the founder and president of Strategic Coach. They were gracious enough to have a book bundle of four of his most recent books. And there were three lucky winners. We'll announce their names on the show tonight, and they are on their way to the lucky winners. We also have a new offer in place. You could win my new book by sending a text to 66866, 66866, and text the word bottom line as one word. Bottom line, and you'll automatically be entered into a drawing to win a hardcover edition of my new book. You can follow me on social media. The easiest way is probably on Twitter, YSaftlas, YSAFTLAS, and that's where we talk about who our upcoming guests are going to be. Well, with us in studio tonight, we have none other than Eric Enquist, Assistant Managing Editor at Crain's New York Business. Some information about our distinguished guest. Eric is the highly acclaimed assistant managing editor at Crain's. He heads Crain's political coverage for both New York City and state government, New York State government. Crain's is also the editor at Crain's Insider, a blog read by thousands and business leaders and certainly by political junkies. Therefore, we encourage you to stay tuned for tonight's edition of Mind Your Business to learn about the world of journalism. We're also going to talk about trending topics. We're going to talk about Uber and New York City, the feud or friendship or whatever you want to call it between Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio. We have a lot to talk about. This is going to be a lot of fun. With that intro, we give a warm welcome to Eric Enquist. Eric, how are you?
I'm well. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. Eric, over the years, I mean, you've been at Crain's now for a decade plus. You're always on the other side of the story, and here we have the honor of interviewing you and asking you questions. I hope you're going to enjoy this. Certainly the listeners are going to get a kick out of this because your name is very well known in the industry, and people want to hear your story, and tonight will be that platform. Let's talk about the world of journalism. How did you get into the field?
Well, I got into it in college when I worked for the college newspaper. And, you know, the thing about journalism is once you get bitten by the bug, and it's really hard to
I thought that's only for politics.
Politics, boxing, and journalism. You hear that phrase in those, when you get bitten by the bug. And I tell you, it's such a great job because, you know, how many jobs do you get to just call up anyone you want and ask questions? And basically, they're usually happy to answer them. So if you're a curious person, if you're inquisitive, if you like to break news, it's a great field to be in. So that's the draw. That's the draw for journalists.
And what's the most fascinating part about being a journalist?
I think for me, it's just being able to get an answer to any question. You know, I mean, you can of course, in the age of Google, right, you have any question, you Google it
right
now. But there's actually quite a bit that you cannot find on Google, you know, in terms of insight or what's happening next. Google can't tell you that. What
right
you really need are the people who are inside those industries, those fields, the experts to tell you everything you need to know about a subject. And as a journalist, you can just call them up, email them, and you get the answers. Like, there's no other field where you can just get answers like that from decision makers, from power brokers, from people who matter, and for that matter, people on the street. You know, if you just walk up randomly and ask someone a question, they're going to look at you cross-eyed. But if you come up and say, you know, I'm a reporter, I'm writing a story and such, let me ask you about this, they're usually happy to talk to you. So it's a great field if you're interested in anything about the world.
Hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit more about how journalism works. How does a great story take shape, if I could ask? I mean, I know it's a general question, but I'd love to ask you that.
Well, you know, stories can start in any number of ways. Journalists can, who know their field very well, can just have a thought that occurs to them, and they might say, you know, here's an unanswered question. Here's an issue that I see coming up. Because I know this field very well, you know, it just sort of hits you like a lightning bolt. And you think, you know, no one's written about this. No one's talked about this. But this is going to be a big deal. And so you get out there and you write something and suddenly it gets traction. You know, it's and the feedback is really great. I mean, I've had this experience numerous times, most recently, I think, with the Uber story and mm-hmm taxis, which was an undercovered story for a while. And now is getting a lot more attention. Mm-hmm. So that's one way a story could come in. Another way is people just call you. People call out of the blue. It could be a whistleblower. It could be someone on the inside of something who knows something that no one else knows because he's in a position to know. Sometimes that person doesn't have a vehicle to get that message out other than the media. Mm-hmm. And if you have a relationship with that person or he knows your newspaper or your radio show for that matter, that person may just call you up and just give you a gift of a story. Now, of course, for every call like that, you might get 5 or 6 calls or 10 calls that the person thinks it's a story but is not. And then you got to sort of talk that person
right
out of it and explain why you can't do it. So we have a lot of that as well. And it's not a very well understood field. You know, a lot of people don't understand why something is not a story. But when a story comes in that's hot, you know, you just know it right away.
So how much is reactive versus proactive? What I mean by that is obviously a journalist has to have their their nose to the ground in order to ear to the ground, whatever the expression is, in order to really know what story to run with. But are there, you touched on it before, are there some stories that in theory you could say, you know what, I'm going to pitch this, I'm going to throw this story out there. It's not trending in any which way, but I think it's going to be a story. That's what I mean by proactive. What percentage of that goes on?
I would say that, roughly speaking, probably 40% of stories are like that, where it's self-generated, maybe 30%. Uh-huh. Most of them are sort
of in response to something.
They're in response to either someone calling you or some other development in the news that triggers some new question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the governor may announce something, and then that sets the news off in a different direction, something that didn't exist before. And then there are a bunch of questions that need to be answered, and we're the people who answer them.
Amazing. Here's an interesting question. You're doing this over a decade. Who is the most interesting person you've ever met? Or if I can ask, can I put you on the spot with that? Or you may say a few.
There are so many. You know, the one of the most mysterious people, at least on today's political stage, I think is Andrew Cuomo, our governor. He, it's really hard to get a handle sometimes on what he's going to do next, what's motivating him, what his ambitions are, what his goals, what's driving him. And here's a guy who can also turn on a dime. You know, one day he's de Blasio's friend. The next day, he's his enemy. The next day, he's breaking bread again. And he's a liberal. Then he's a fiscal conservative. And now he's a liberal again. You know, it's really hard to predict. And of all the people I've covered in politics, you know, most people sort of stay the same.
I mean, they're predictable a bit.
They are predictable. You know, you can tell what position they're going to have on this issue or that, how they're going to play the politics of any particular issue. And Cuomo kind of moves around quite a bit. So, you know, he could be your enemy one day and your friend the next. And he's a guy who's also known for thinking several steps ahead. So he plots things out. And so it's fun to sort of think along with him. Okay, what he's announcing this today. What's his end game here? And you got to be able to look two or three steps down the road as to what it will get him. And he's pretty good at it. But he's not perfect, so which is great for us for journalists.
I was going to say
when they screw up, you know, we just have
a
field
story.
Yeah, you got a story. You know, whether they're whether he's right or wrong, you have a story because he's always interesting. So he's one guy I would mention as just a fascinating person to write about, and he's a little bit elusive because it can be hard to pin him down on something, and other times, you know, he's the kind of guy who. He works three blocks south of us. We're in Midtown at Crane's, mm-hmm. and Governor Cuomo's New York City office, his Midtown office, is only three blocks away from us. And once in a while, he will just call up, and he will say, I'd like to come in. Huh. And he will just bring his entourage, and he will walk three blocks north, and he will show up in our office, and will sit down with us for an hour. And, you know, it may have been a year since we even got him on the phone or, you know, got any kind of contact with him. And suddenly he'll just show up and just talk for an hour, no script, nothing. And, you know, sometimes you wonder, like, what's he getting at here? Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, last time he did that, he kind of got himself in a little trouble, I would say, because this was when he had formed the Moreland Commission, which was a commission that was going to investigate right. corruption in government.
Right.
And this was before the indictments and everything.
Right, and everything.
So he had formed this commission, and then the legislature was kind of afraid of what it was doing because it was looking into all their dealings.
Right.
The governor was trying to get the legislature to pass an ethics bill. So he used this commission as leverage. You know, he said, I'm going to investigate you guys. And by the way, if you pass my bill, maybe we'll forget about the commission. And of course, that's exactly what they did. They eventually cut a deal where they agreed to pass not the entire bill, but a piece of it. And in exchange, Cuomo dropped the commission. And we editorialized. And one of the things I do at Crane's is I write the masthead editorials every week, mm-hmm. Speaking for the paper. And we editorialized that it was a bad decision that he had made, because we didn't think he got enough out of it. You know, he got a few incremental improvements in ethics laws in the state, and this is, you know, he needed much more than that. He needed a major overhaul of the reform because the cesspool up there is just so vast and seemingly endless. And we didn't think he got enough. And in exchange, he shut down this commission, which seemed to be onto something. And the commission was stacked with former prosecutors
yeah.
and people who knew
yeah.
what they were doing. And they were really into it. So and they had opened up a line of inquiries, a number of them, which seemed to be bearing fruit. And of course, that is exactly the reason that the legislature caved in on the ethics bill and said, OK, we'll pass. We'll pass some of it. Just make this commission go away. And the governor did make it go away. He closed it down. So he showed up after our editorial ran. I think that was probably what prompted him to come in.
Mm.
Didn't really like what we had written about it. And he said, you know what? You know, it was my commission. You know, I created it. You know, I can shut it down. So, you know, the whole notion that he had kind of interfered with the commission, I think he kind of rejected that because he said, you know, it's not like it wasn't mine to interfere with. It was my commission. I made it. So therefore, I could do whatever I want with it, including close it down, which is what he did. But that backfired. It backfired because a guy named Preet Bharara, who happens to be the top federal prosecutor
right.
for Manhattan and Westchester County, said, you know, that you can't do that. You can't just shut down an investigation like that because of a political deal, especially since dirt had started to show
yeah.
up, possible corruption,
yeah.
possible criminal activity. So the U.S. attorney stepped in and he basically grabbed every file that the Moreland Commission was working on and said, you know, we're going to continue this. Of course, now the legislature got the short
yeah.
end of the stick
yeah,
here because they had cut the deal to make the commission go away. And they agreed to the ethics reform, and then the commission was basically reincarnated within the office of Preet Bharara, just different people, but the
yeah.
same files, the same cases.
Yeah. And a lot more serious, probably.
And a lot more serious because, yeah. again, a Moreland Commission is probably not going to bring a federal indictment,
right.
but the U.S. attorney is. He's
yeah.
not going to invest all those resources and come out with nothing.
Yeah.
So, and of course, he came out with some indictments. He indicted the top two leaders of the state legislature, the majority leader of the Senate, Dean Skelos, and Shelley Silver, who'd been the assembly speaker for decades, and both of them ended up convicted. So it was just an amazing saga to cover that whole thing. And, you know, to have played a little role in that is kind of a, you know, feather in your cap if you're a journalist. And, you know, Cuomo, he had been an extremely popular governor to that point. And the whole fallout from the Moreland Commission and his interference and then shutting it down, it knocked about 25 points off his approval rating.
Yeah.
That is, you know, so that completely changed the tenor of his governorship. Mm. He had been basically walking on water to that point with close to 70% approval rating. Where we, you know, when you're that high, you can almost do whatever you want, right? Because the legislature has to listen to you because you have the bully pulpit and you have the people on your side. And when you're in the 40% range, you don't. You know, it's much tougher to get people to listen to you at that point. Now, he's still a very strong executive, but it has not been the same since then.
Is there any inside story to the LaGuardia Airport? Last summer, he announced a $4 billion renovation plan for LaGuardia. Is there anything else to the story? I mean, we all know LaGuardia is, you know, that's one where the vice president maybe was on the ball, but in what he said, third world airport.
Joe Biden did compare it to a third world country's airport. There is a little more to that story. What's interesting about it is the Port Authority was already in the process of recreating the central terminal, which is so that's sort of ground zero. If you're going to fix up LaGuardia Airport, you got to start with the central terminal. So they had this whole process in place, central terminal building. They had basically contracts lined up, a whole plan in the works. And just as they were about to execute it, the governor came in and said, you know what, let's have a design contest and redesign the central terminal. And Port Authority's like, wait a second. We were about to do that, and you're going to start the whole thing again? And this is the kind of thing that Cuomo does sometimes because he likes projects to be his, have his signature on a project. And by doing that, he may have set the project back some number of months or longer. It may be cost, maybe it's going to cost more as a result. It usually does when you delay things. But now it'll sort of be his project, so he could take ownership of it. He's done this on a number of occasions. Sometimes it works. Sometimes they end up with a better project. Sometimes they end up with a faster project. But it's his project. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the ideas are so haywire that they never happen.
So who was he upending with LaGuardia project?
You know, the Port Authority is a bi-state agency. So the governor of New York and the governor of New Jersey both essentially control the agency because they have appointments to it. And they appoint the commissioners. And usually the New Jersey projects, those defer to the New Jersey governor and, you know, Chris Christie, and New York projects defer to the New York governor. So, you know, there was nothing that the Port Authority staff could really do about it when the governor stepped in because it was kind of his prerogative to do it. I know they weren't happy about it, but, you know, you just got to make do because he is essentially their boss. So eventually, I assume that project will get done. You know, one project that won't get done is, in my opinion, is his idea for an air train to LaGuardia. Now, people have been dreaming about a train to LaGuardia for years because it's not that easy to get to the airport. So he had this idea we were going to run an air train, but we're going to come from the other direction, not from the city. So if you were in Manhattan, under his plan, you'd have to go past LaGuardia and then take the air train back. So, you know, people in the transportation field looked at this and said, what is he thinking? And I cover transportation, too, so one of my beats. And I just couldn't figure it out because, you know, the people who follow this know actually the MTA has a pretty good bus that you can now take sort of the F train to Queens and get on this Q70 bus. And you're really at LaGuardia in no time at all. I mean, you can get there from Midtown in 25 minutes.
You take the N or whatever. There's a cut.
And the price is $2.75. You really can't beat it. Can't beat it. And the bus is pretty fast. It comes every 10 minutes. People who work at the airport take it routinely. It's one of the best kept secrets in New York City. And it's actually not very well promoted by the MTA. And I'm beginning to think one of the reasons they don't promote it is because they didn't want to step on the governor's idea of, you know, a train to LaGuardia. And that's, you know, I'm getting into conspiracy theories a little bit here. But they really could make more of this bus if they wanted to. In fact, there's a whole group that said, you know, why not change the name from Q70 to LaGuardia Shuttle, right, LGA, something that people can recognize. Right. But and you know how much it costs to build an air train. I mean,
I remember the JFK. I remember the JFK air train, and when I was growing up, there was no transportation to JFK. I remember the ads for the A take the train to the plane, and there was the special A train that would skip stops and kind of loop through Manhattan. But it was very difficult to get to JFK.
It was mass transit. The train didn't go all the way to the plane until they built the air train, which, you know, of course, cost two or three times what they said it was going to cost, and took much longer. But it eventually did get done. Yeah. But at least that train made logical sense. The LaGuardia air train really doesn't make any sense because it would come from the other direction. You'd have to take the LIRR
past the 7, LaGuardia. Right, or the 7. Right?
Yeah, so it would not save you any time. And the governor initially said that it would cost $450 million. And within a few days, the MTA chairman kind of sheepishly admitted that it would probably cost closer to $1 billion. And, you know, that means it would actually cost $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
So, you know, like that project is probably never going to happen. You know, just last week, you know, he continues to do this. You know, early in January, Cuomo came out with a whole bunch of projects that he was going to do or wanted to at least explore. And one of them was a tunnel for cars under the Long Island Sound, which is an idea that's kicked around since the 60s. And the reason it hasn't happened is because it's frankly not a very good idea. And suddenly he decided that people who are commuting between Connecticut and Long Island should be able to get there a little bit faster. Maybe wouldn't have to divert all the way to the Throgs Neck Bridge. And so they would build this car tunnel. But, you know, really no one's building car tunnels anymore.
Yeah, certainly for the cost, billions of dollars. You know,
So he's spending he's just going to spend $5 million studying it. But even that got some of the fiscally conservative groups in New York upset. It's like their reaction was, you know what? $5 million is not nothing. Like,
right.
Why would we just waste it?
Even though it's just a study, but still. Yeah.
Why waste it on a project that is never going to happen and never should happen? So I think I'm not even sure that study will get done. So he's kind of a mystery man in that way. You know, the Penn Station renovation project is something that people have been looking for years. And there was a lot of excitement when Governor Cuomo said, you know, I'm going to put this on the front burner and we're going to get something done within 3 years. And people said, you know what, that's great. You want to get something done. And this is what we at Crane said. But why not wait until Madison Square Garden is no longer on top of Penn Station? Wouldn't that make it a lot easier to fix up the station?
Get in there.
Because, you know, Madison Square Garden's permit runs out.
Yeah.
It's a 10-year permit. They're 3 years into it. So 7 years from now, they could be forced to move.
Right.
And if they were, you could just knock the garden down and build, let some daylight into the station. You have a lot easier time.
Deal with it.
You could get rid of all those columns that support you ever wonder why it's so cramped down there? So all these columns supporting this gigantic arena right on top of it, you could really make
it incredible, the labyrinth. I mean, between the Jersey Transit and Long Island Railroad and the city system going through, I mean, the A and the 1, 2, 3, and I mean,
it's a maze, and let's not forget Amtrak. So it's just a complete maze.
Amtrak.
No one can figure out. Even New Yorkers who use it routinely have a hard time navigating Penn Station, and it's such a cramped, and you just
tight,
don't get a good,
tight.
You don't get a feeling of a majestic entrance to gateway to New York City.
Right, like you do with Grand Central.
Right, like you do with Grand Central, a majestic big train hall, you know, a gigantic concourse.
Yeah.
Penn Station is this little dungeon. And by the way, 600,000 people a day are going through that station.
Wow.
I mean, it is one of the biggest, most important transit hubs on the planet. And for us to treat it the way we do, and of course, the only reason this happened is because they knocked down the old Penn Station way back in the early 60s. So here's our chance to do it right. And it's great that at Crane, so it was great the governor wants to get behind this. And we still think that way. But we just think if you're going to do it right, wait till you can. And you can't do it right if there's a basketball arena right on top of it.
We're speaking with Eric Enquist, the assistant managing editor at Crain's New York Business, right here on Mind Your Business with Yusuf Saftalis on 77 WABC and around the world at WABCBizRadio.com. We're going to take a short commercial break and back in a moment. Stay tuned.
Best Payroll delivers the affordable payroll solutions you need so that you could focus on your business. Today's payroll laws are complicated and constantly changing. Why should you have to worry about keeping yourself up to date with these details when you can rely on Best Payroll's fully bonded tax service to take care of it for you? Best Payroll has been managing the payroll needs of small to mid-sized companies across the country since 1989. Their experienced and dedicated professionals are committed to providing you with cost-effective payroll management solutions. Why spend your time, money, and effort handling your business's payroll when you could rely on Best Payroll to get the job done right at a price you can't beat? To learn more what Best Payroll can do for your company, dial 347-729-2355. That's 347-729-2355. Or visit bestpayroll.net. That's bestpayroll.net. Best Payroll, the experienced payroll professional, radio host, and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis, has written the essential book for the success-driven, fast-paced professional. So, What's the Bottom Line is a must-read for marketing your business and building your personal brand. Bill O'Reilly raves, So, What's the Bottom Line is an indispensable resource for anyone looking to make a mark in today's world. So, What's the Bottom Line is available now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookstores nationwide. Get your copy today.
And we're back here on 77 WABC. This is the Mind Your Business show. I'm here with Eric Enquist, special guest here this evening, the assistant managing editor at Crain's. Just a couple of notes. Here we go. I wanted to mention the winners for the Dan Sullivan book bundle. They are Ellen Shapiro, John Gambardella, sorry, and Stephen Langer. Your book bundles will be in the mail shortly. Thank you for entering. And this week it's a new giveaway, and that is if you text 66866, that's the number. One word, bottom line. Just put in the word bottom line, text to 66866, and you'll be entered into win a book, the So What's the Bottom Line book, 76 Proven Marketing Tips and Techniques for Building Your Business and Your Personal Brand. Also wanted to mention a special thank you to last week's guest, Peter Shankman. His podcast is up. It's on our iTunes store. The easiest way to find it is to go to WABCBizRadio.com, WABCBizRadio.com. All our guests are up there. You could hear the interview we had with Captain Sully Sullenberger. Actually, when we interviewed him, I'm going to mention this to Eric now. When we interviewed him a couple of months ago, it was after the decision had been announced at LaGuardia about the expansion, and they did not discuss lengthening the runways. So he's someone that has dealt with that, navigating. We know how short those runways are, and he actually complained on the air. He said, you know, why would they be doing, basically to the effect, they're investing $4 billion into that terminal, you know, like kind of just extend the runways a little bit.
Well, it's not as easy as you think. LaGuardia is surrounded by water. So at the moment, you can't just throw some more pavement down there. You'd actually have to fill in the seawater.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not an easy project. It's not a cheap project. I'm not expecting that to happen anytime soon. There are ways to make LaGuardia more efficient. Longer runways are helpful from a safety perspective, but I would not hold my breath for that project.
Yeah, interesting. Although the runway is, there is a portion of each of the runways that do go into and are, you know, reinforced all over the water.
I think any traveler given the choice between JFK and LaGuardia is going to fly in the JFK, especially if you're coming in at night. Yeah. I'm not trying to scare anyone, but on a dark and rainy night, honestly, where would you rather land?
Now, I've come into LaGuardia on a dark and rainy night, and you feel the way the pilot is braking hard. And I always talk about that, you know, finally, when it comes to a stop, you look at the window and like you see cars in the Grand Central, like just like a few feet, you know, whatever, a couple hundred feet. But
LaGuardia was not really, it's not a monument to great urban planning, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, it was, there's no great way to get there, although we did mention the bus train connection that they finally, but still, you wouldn't design it that way.
Yeah.
You wouldn't put it right in the middle of a bunch of residential neighborhoods.
Yeah.
The people there, of course, live around it, hate it because the planes all the time. And it's cramped. You know, I guess people didn't envision at the time where air travel was going, where you'd have bigger jets and you'd need more space. And LaGuardia can't really provide that.
Yeah. Let's talk about Uber and the city. In fact, a few days ago, you moderated the conference. Cranes New York Business had a special conference, and Commissioner Joshi was attended. And that whole subject about the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission and Uber. Let's talk about that subject. We know that Uber's rise has put a lot of pressure on taxis. And last summer, during the summer of 15, it came to a head, and the mayor took a strong stand against it. In fact, in today's this week's Cranes, so they actually have a story on it, and it says, and they came out and said, well, Uber actually isn't making Manhattan's traffic more congested, and that's the conclusion of a $2 million study. So maybe you can elaborate on this whole story.
Well, Uber is a fascinating topic, absolutely fascinating. You know, it's not that old. Uber started in basically 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only, 4 or 5 years ago. And really, it was only mid-2014 that Uber really started to add drivers. They made a big push, mm-hmm. and they just exploded. They actively recruited drivers. And a lot of drivers left yellow cabs to drive for Uber. Now, just to put this in perspective, there are still four times as many yellow cab trips made in New York City as there are Uber trips.
Okay.
But there are 30,000 Uber vehicles. They're not on the road all the time, but mm-hmm. there are 30,000 of them compared to 13,500 yellow cabs.
Wow.
And one thing about yellow cabs is you got to have drivers. And if your drivers are going to other companies, Uber, Lyft, Via, Get, there's a bunch of them now, but mostly Uber, you can't put your cab on the road without a driver. And so what these medallion owners, a medallion owner is someone who sort of owns the right to operate a cab, but mostly they're leasing them out to other drivers. They're not mm-hmm. driving them themselves. If they can't find drivers, then there's no revenue coming in for that cab. And, they have to pay off their medallion loan.
How much is a medallion?
Just like you would, it's like a house. It works the same way as a house, basically. You borrow money, you have a mortgage on to buy your medallion, because most of these guys have paid anywhere from, $500,000 to $1 million for one medallion. And the reason they paid so much is because for a long time, taxis owned the road. Taxis own the road in New York City. So anytime you had a taxi on the street, you could basically pick up passengers left and right as often as you wanted to. And there was no trouble getting drivers to drive them either, because it paid reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take a whole lot to become a taxi driver. You didn't have to speak great English. So it was a very popular field for people who are new to the country and needed to make money fast to support their families, and they would do so. And eventually their goal was usually to save up enough money to buy a medallion themselves. And a lot of people really established themselves and put their kids through college driving cabs, saving up money, buying medallion, and then renting it out, driving it themselves. And then after a number of years, they would sell the medallion, usually for a big profit, because they would rise in value, as anything does when there's a limited supply. And there's always been a limited supply of medallions, and there wasn't a lot of competition, because the only other way to get a car would be to call up and wait.
Right.
And which is a
like
lot
the
harder.
Car service.
Yeah, which is a lot harder than just sticking your hand up and flagging someone down.
Right.
Taxis have the exclusive right to pick up people who flag them down. Well, along comes Uber. You can't stick your hand up and flag an Uber, but you can stick your hand into your phone,
smartphone,
press
boom.
Two buttons, and you have a car in 2 minutes.
Two, three minutes.
Their average response time in Manhattan is 2 minutes. Their average response time in Brooklyn is 4 minutes.
Yeah,
So it's almost instantaneous, and it's a lot easier in much of the city to find an Uber than it is to find a cab.
Right.
You may pay a little bit more. But you know, that's not really an issue if you're trying to get from one place to another.
And it's not a lot more. It's really negligible.
It's not a lot more. So Uber started to make all these inroads, and they started actively. They were telling drivers, you can make $90,000 a year. You can make $47 an hour. And people are like, wow, that's a lot of money. It's more than I'm making driving a cab. Let me switch over. And you know, some of them, we've heard mixed experiences from mm-hmm. these. Some people say Uber didn't deliver on its promises. But I think for the most part, drivers have voted with their feet. And some of them have come back to Yellow Cabs, but a lot of them have not. And then you have people who were never drivers who just got into the business because it was paying more than whatever they were doing before. You know, we have a lot of low-wage workers in New York City, and if you're making $9 an hour on a retail job, right, and Uber comes along and says you can make $47, you figure, well, even if that's not true, even if I make $27, right, that's three times more than I'm making right now. Let me try that. So Uber knows this competition is going to be won by getting drivers, and that's where they focus their efforts.
Right. They had ads on city buses.
Right, so they won that. So now the medallion owners are coming in and saying, we need some help. I mean, a lot of these guys start to default on their loans. And just like
the homeowners, right? I mean, just same thing. Give back the keys to the bank.
Same thing for the housing crisis.
Wow.
You know, they
the value was less than, so just take back the keys.
Yeah, so the banks started to foreclose. You know, and there are a lot of medallion owners who want to keep their medallions, even though they're probably worth less now than they paid for them.
Right.
But you still have to make the loan payments. And you can't make the loan payments if you can't find a driver to drive your cab and to pay you lease money for that. So you have some folks who have literally put their medallions into storage.
Wow.
And you know, by the way, there are some medallions. Yeah. There are two different kinds of medallions. Most people don't know this. There's the corporate medallions where you can just buy them and lease them out to drivers, and individual medallions where there's a requirement that you, as the owner, do a certain amount of driving yourself. Well, some of these guys bought individual medallions decades ago. They're actually too old or not healthy enough to drive them anymore. So I think 900 hours a year is the minimum. So they could do some minimal amount of driving, but of course they can't find enough drivers to fill in the rest of that time. So is
Uber, you know what, let me ask the question this way. Was it de Blasio's battle, or he was really battling it on behalf of the Taxi and Limousine Commission?
You know, this is interesting. You know, Taxi and Limousine Commission basically reports to Bill de Blasio, the mayor, and Mira Zoshi is his commissioner. She runs that agency. But because there was this big public fight where the mayor threatened to temporarily cap the growth of Uber and other rivals of Uber, to do a study on congestion, allegedly, there was this popular sentiment took hold that the mayor was against Uber because he had gotten a lot of money from the taxi industry for his campaign, which is true. But what people missed is that these taxi interests were suing the city of New York to force the Taxi and Limousine Commission to stop Uber from making these electronic hail pickups. Because, as I mentioned earlier, an electronic hail is not that unlike a hail where you stick your hand up and hail a taxi. Instead of putting your hand up, you just put your hand on your phone.
Right.
And
so that's just capitalism. Like, what do you have against capitalism?
So, well, here's the thing. The taxi people said, you know what? That is our exclusive right. That's why we paid $800,000 for these medallions, so we could exclusively pick up people on the street corners of New York City. And just because they are hailing cars with a phone rather than, you know, putting their hand up, it's our domain. So they sued the city of New York. They sued the Taxi and Limousine Commission. They sued Mayor de Blasio.
Wow.
And they said, TLC, you've got to stop Uber from doing this. And de Blasio defended Uber in this case. Uber, by the way, was not part of the case. It was strictly to try to get enforcement of e-hails, to stop e-hails. And de Blasio's view was e-hails are different from street hails, where you put your hand up, and it's okay for Uber to do this. And so
see, this is really between a rock and a hard place.
That was kind of lost in the noise of all this stuff about the cap. But the fact is, without e-hails, there is no Uber, right? That's the backbone of their business. That is their whole business. And so, you know, Uber has a team of lobbyists, and, you know, certainly
That's That's the difference in their case over other special interests. They had an incredible team that was able to. I mean, I'm sure you knew what was going on, and the team that they put in place. I mean, many former chiefs of staff and
a lot of Bloomberg people worked there, and some people used to work for Cuomo. And I'll tell you, they did a great job with the public relations and the politics.
And to get the average citizen involved, I mean, they really went out full force.
Right. And basically they targeted the city council to get on their side, and they found enough city council members to support them that the bill was withdrawn.
And then,
by the way, there was a separate side fight over who withdrew the bill. You know, the mayor came out and said, you know, I'm going to withdraw this bill. Right. And the city council speaker, Melissa Mark Verita, said, wait a second, I withdrew this bill. You know, this is a council decision. And then you had this whole separate battle, you know, who deserved the credit for doing this. And she felt the mayor was kind of stepping on her toes a little bit, minimizing her
authority.
So
and
there's just so many rifts in this. There's just drama left and right. And of course, there's a lot of money involved. The medallions alone at one time were worth about $10 billion. Just New York City taxi medallions are worth about $10 billion of value
to the city,
held by not too many folks. So, you know, their lives, their business lives were at stake. And then from the city's point of view, the city, when Uber was just starting to become popular, the city was planning to sell 2,000 more medallions. You know, at $1 million each, that would have been $2 billion for the city.
Right.
And so they were going to reap a lot of money off this. And all of a sudden, medallion values went down. And the city said, you know what? We can't sell them. We can't auction medallions in this environment.
Becoming Uber drivers.
It would be like selling new condos in the middle of the housing crash. You know, you just couldn't do it. So they canceled that. They claim eventually they're going to do it, but I'm not sure that they ever will. And, of course, the medallion owners don't want any more medallions sold because it sort of dilutes their field and their assets. So they just hold on for dear life.
Amazing. First of all, again, Eric, I can't thank you enough for being here. In the few remaining minutes, let's talk a little bit about the Governor Cuomo, Mayor de Blasio feud, if you will. Ted Cruz came out and bashed New York two weeks ago. Will that put them two together, or do you see Cuomo endorsing de Blasio in 17? I mean, where do you take this?
You know, it's hard to wrap this saga up in a couple minutes.
Okay.
But Cuomo, when he was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Clinton administration, de Blasio worked under him. They were on the same side. Cuomo ran for governor in 2002. De Blasio endorsed him. De Blasio introduced him in his district. And Cuomo couldn't say enough good things about de Blasio in those days. And then fast forward, you know, one's the governor, one's the mayor, and suddenly Cuomo starts to pick fights with Bill de Blasio, and it starts to get ugly. And then now we're in the presidential campaign. They both endorsed Hillary Clinton. I have my own theory that Hillary's people got involved here, and looking ahead, they said to themselves, wouldn't it be nice to have a united Democratic front in New York with the two most powerful elected officials in New York on the, you know, not fighting with each other if they're going to be supporting my campaign? I've got a competitive race against Bernie Sanders. You know, let's try to get them on the same page. So maybe it was someone from her camp who had the idea, you know, okay, Ted Cruz said something bad about New York. This is an opportunity for you guys to get together and show, you know, united front and
kiss and make up.
And maybe they have to an extent, but of course there's still an undercurrent, an unmistakable undercurrent of hostility between the two. And it was really initiated by Governor Cuomo. De Blasio didn't know what to make of it, didn't know what to do about it.
Right.
He felt bullied, and you know, eventually he stood up and fought back. And that really, maybe that only made things worse. I'm not sure.
And that was interesting because it's reported in this week's issue of Crane's New York Business, where they talk about when Karen Hinton came over. So that, you know, then...
So Karen Hinton worked for Cuomo at one time.
Right.
And then when Bill de Blasio hired her, Cuomo was just outraged. But this is, it's petty. I mean, in my opinion, it's petty. Okay, someone who worked for you as a Cuomo loyalist suddenly goes to work for Bill de Blasio, you know, who you've taken on as an enemy by your own choice.
Right.
Therefore, you should be outraged when she goes to work for him. You know, to me, that was really childish. But, you know, by all accounts, he was very upset by it. And it was, I think, Karen Hinton who told Bill de Blasio, you've got to stand up for yourself.
Take the gloves off.
You can't let him push you around because it's never going to change unless you stand up. And he did kind of stand up for himself. And it changed. The governor maybe stepped back initially, but then he just kept at it. So
once we're talking politics, what's your take on Sarah Palin's endorsement of Donald Trump?
Well, I guess Sarah Palin still has a following. It is not a huge following like it was a few years ago. And maybe there are some people who vote for Trump instead of Ted Cruz because Sarah Palin tells them to. But, I mean, all things being equal, I guess you'd rather have Sarah Palin if you're Trump than not.
Okay.
Is it a game changer? No, it's not a game changer. But I think she is probably making a choice. She said she liked both of them. She's probably trying to pick the winner at this point because you always want to endorse the winner.
Yeah, ride with that.
Yeah. Whenever you hear an endorsement, you know, it's not just because the person loves the person being endorsed.
Now,
there's always
funny.
Some handicapping involved.
It's funny you say that because I'll never forget Giuliani's endorsement of Mario Cuomo versus Pataki. I remember that.
Mm, yeah.
It was 20 years ago, a little more than that. And exactly that point, I mean, all the pundits said it was pretty because he was handicapped. It was handicapping that race, mm-hmm. and Mario Cuomo was ahead in the polls. You remember that race?
Right, you try to pick a winner, and then maybe he'll get something back. Because the governor is very powerful.
Did that explode on him?
Backfired.
Yeah, because he endorsed a Dem, and he's a Republican. I mean, that was
it backfired.
Ouch.
Well, Pataki won the race.
Yeah,
I mean, so that
ouch.
Yeah, and they were off to a flying start from that point. That relationship.
That's one way to put it. A flying start. Eric, I can't thank you enough for joining me here on this edition of Mind Your Business. Any final thoughts for the audience that you'd like to share?
Well, I would encourage people to pick up their newspapers. Like, everyone's getting their news in 1,000 different places these mm-hmm. days, and sort of eyeballs are everywhere now. So it's become harder for newspapers to stay in business. And you see a lot of them really going out of business or cutting back on publication because their audience has just been sort of splintered all over the place. But newspapers still are a valuable part of the national conversation, and with just imagine what America would be like without them. Actually, that's not a pretty picture. So I would encourage people, sit down, don't just watch 6-second vines all day long. Sit down and read your newspaper. They're just fascinating ways to learn about the world.
Amazing. Well, that was the voice of Eric Enquist. If you're just tuning in, the podcast will be up later in the week, and you'll be able to hear the entire interview that we just had with the assistant managing editor at Crain's New York Business. Eric, thank you so much for joining me here on Mind Your
Business. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, that was Eric Enquist. Again, the entire interview will be up on the podcast on the iTunes channel within a couple of days. Stay tuned. Right after this commercial break, we'll wrap up the show. Stay tuned.
Best Payroll delivers the affordable payroll solutions you need so that you could focus on your business. Today's payroll laws are complicated and constantly changing. Why should you have to worry about keeping yourself up to date with these details when you can rely on Best Payroll's fully bonded tax service to take care of it for you? Best Payroll has been managing the payroll needs of small to mid-sized companies across the country since 1989. Their experienced and dedicated professionals are committed to providing you with cost-effective payroll management solutions. Why spend your time, money, and effort handling your business's payroll when you could rely on Best Payroll to get the job done right at a price you can't beat? To learn more what Best Payroll can do for your company, dial 347-729-2355. That's 347-729-2355. Or visit bestpayroll.net. That's bestpayroll.net. Best Payroll, the experienced payroll professionals.
Your company website is crucial to your success, providing information about your services and programs. It has to deliver just the right message, the right way, to make customers excited about what you offer and interested in working with you. Online, you have to be on the money to make the money. So go with the best, Website with Brains. Their experienced team will plan, write, design, and program a winning website that combines simplicity and flexibility with powerful features that will make you the king of content marketers. And they make it so easy. All of their websites are made with an easy, user-friendly interface. Website with Brains will have your new website up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. Take control of your online marketing today. Call Website with Brains for a free consultation and see how they can improve your online presence. 1-800-WEB-9018. That's 1-800-WEB-9018. Or visit them online at websitewithbrains.com.
Author, radio host, and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis, has written the essential book for the success-driven, fast-paced professional. So, What's the Bottom Line? Is a must-read for marketing your business and building your personal brand. Former U.S. Congressman and media executive Bob Turner describes So, What's the Bottom Line? As a compass to guide the experienced executive or marketing novice through any step in planning or organizing a selling strategy. So, What's the Bottom Line is available now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookstores nationwide. Get your copy today.
And we're back here on 77 WABC, the legendary 77 WABC. And that was a great interview we had with Eric Enquist, the senior, well, actually the assistant managing editor at Crain. Certainly has that accolade. He's been with Crain's New York Business for over a decade. Certainly anyone in government politics here in the city or in the state knows the name Eric Enquist. He's a very familiar name. So many people follow him. This was one really incredible interview. And you can hear his interview and so many others by going to WABCBizRadio.com, WABCBizRadio.com. One of the interviews that got tremendous play was the recent one we had with Dan Sullivan, the founder and president of Strategic Coach, and he talked about strategy and the importance of taking focus days and free days in order to clear your mind, in order to grow your business. That's really an incredible interview as well. That's also available on the iTunes channel. The easiest way to get to it is by going to WABCBizRadio.com, WABCBizRadio.com. Well, now I'd actually like to talk about my new book that just came out recently, published by Morgan James, 260 pages. The title is So What's the Bottom Line? It's 76 Proven Marketing Tips and Techniques for Building Your Business and Your Personal Brand. You can download a free chapter of the book by visiting sowhatsthebottomline.com. Now, that's actually a rather long URL, and as a company that builds websites, we usually encourage people not to have a long URL. So, yes, we violated our own rule here. We apologize. But if you go to Google and you type in, So What's the Bottom Line, it will come up. The book is available on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, and some of the Hudson booksellers, so many others. It's there, and you can order it. Actually, on the website, there's a very interesting video that we had right here in the studios at WABC on a special show that was hosted by T.J. McCormick. He's a lot of fun. And with him, together with Bill O'Reilly, a special shout-out to them, T.J. McCormick, Bill O'Reilly, great friends. Thank you so much. And their video is up on sowhatsthebottomline.com. Well, actually, today I want to talk about the chapter. We've talked about it in the past, and that is the chapter about the 11 power words of marketing. Now, again, you can get this chapter by going to sowhatsthebottomline.com. There's a pop-up right there, and by clicking on it, you can get the chapter of the 11 power words of marketing. Now, this was based on a study done by Yale University. I'm going to list a few of them right here on the show so that you get a feel for how important these words are when you do marketing. And this applies whether you're doing radio ads, you're doing print ads, words on your website, words in any type of marketing that you're doing, in your brochure, in your newsletter, any type of marketing, especially in ads. So let's say you have the word new. New is one of those 11 power words. Not that many people may realize it. New is very important. Now, some people might say, well, if it's new, so then it's unproven. Okay, that's an interesting point, but hey, a study was done by Yale University. You could take their word for it. This word is a marketing favorite. After all, everybody loves to have something that's a novelty. You want something that's new. That's why sometimes they'll say new and improved. It may be an item that's been on the market for 100 years, but they'll say new and improved because the word new is in there. Again, this was done, a study by Yale University. And this chapter is inside my new book, So What's the Bottom Line, which is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and many other, and many bookstores nationwide. Actually, we're giving away a free book tonight also. I just wanted to mention that. If you text 66866 and just one word, put in bottom line as one word, you'll be automatically entered into a drawing to receive this book at no cost, a free copy. All you got to do is text 66866, the word bottom line, and you're automatically entered to win a copy of this book. So let's go back to some more of the power words, because this is great stuff, important stuff. And, you know, so many times studies are done, the difference between certain words that are selected in an ad campaign. You know what a difference that could make? It could really make the difference in how much market share you get, how much retention you get, all the different ways of gauging business growth. Many times come down to a specific word that was chosen or a specific word that purposely was taken out and edited out of an ad. So never discount just one word, because when it comes to marketing, every single word is important and has to be weighed in the overall approach that a company takes. Let's go down to some other examples from the 11 power words of marketing. And that's one of the chapters in my new book, So What's the Bottom Line? The next one I point out is save. Hey, who doesn't want to save time or money, especially in a recession? So if you can get the word save or savings, that's one of the 11 power words that, again, based on the study done at Yale University. Another word, safety. Now, this is a very important word because consumers don't want to spend their mornings, you know, worrying if the toaster is going to zap them, right? And whatever the case is, safety is a very, very big word, especially in today's world. Unfortunately, with the threat of terrorism and crime, etc., safety is a very big word. It's not just for companies that specialize in alarms and all types of cameras, etc., but the word safety, that's definitely ranks up there, and it is one of the 11 power words of marketing. Another one is proven. Now, customers don't like to be a guinea pig for a product or a service. They like to know that if they're part of something, it's established, it's proven, it's reliable. That's why the word proven is one of the 11 power words of marketing. Let me share one or two more in the remaining minute or two that we have here on the air. The word love, right? We all love chocolate and ice cream. The word love is a great word, where appropriate, naturally, but is one of the 11 power words of marketing. Another one, results. Everyone loves results. Now, it's similar to the word proven. It's true. But whenever you could back something up with a result, that goes a very, very long way. Consumers want to know that what they're going to have is proven and also has led to positive results. There's no question that that would. So whether it's in healthcare, that certainly they'll say, you know, this proven formula, blah, 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 and then has resulted in X amount of people living healthier lives, etc. Well, in the remaining time we have on this show, I want to thank everyone again for tuning in to a great edition of Mind Your Business here on 77 WABC. The podcast will be up in a few days, as it always is, by midweek. You'll hear the entire interview we had with Eric Enquist. We discussed a lot, the world of journalism, city politics, state politics. It's all here in this great edition of Mind Your Business. Well, stay tuned for Red Eye. And tune in again next Sunday night at 11 p.m. for another edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis. Every Sunday night from 11 until midnight on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.